wits well, and that had prompted him to go in the opposite direction, but now he possessed Poseidon's trident. And he had been told by the naiad to dive. Taking the trident in hand, he submerged himself in the water and let the strong current sweep him ever downward to reach a door marked with a skull. Pounding fiercely on it produced no result. Kratos pushed away and swam some distance into a crossing channel, hunting for a different path forward. He soon found himself at the bottom of a new well. The light above flickered and danced, as if the fires of Hades burned there. Again the naiad had given him the truth. Now Kratos added one more reason for securing Pandora's box, to stopping the destruction of Athens and killing the god of war. He would free the naiad and all her sisters so they could swim unfettered in the seas again after a millennium of imprisonment. He kicked twice and shot out of the pool, caught himself on the edge, and turned to the opening, through which came the heat and intense light of lava dripping from stone spouts high above into troughs. Kratos went to the portal and quickly assessed everything in the immense room. The ceiling arched more than 100 feet above, with the lava drains pouring out their heated, noxious, molten rock to splatter 20 feet over his head. At his far left towered a statue honoring Lord Hades, but to the right he saw a more curious device. A ballista had been mounted under a catwalk. Kratos found a ladder, mounted, and walked to the firing lever. On impulse he threw the lever, felt the catwalk quake beneath his feet, and then a huge fireball exploded outward to crash into the center of the statue. Kratos grabbed for his weapons when he saw a brightly lit spinning circle appear on the floor at the base of the statue. The glyphs that had vexed him since entering Pandora's temple pulsed with blue light, and moving out into the vast arena between the catwalk and the spinning circle came 4 centaurs. Each armed with a spear. The blades of chaos were comfortable in his hands, but he instinctively knew a more potent weapon would be required. The blade of Artemis whispered out and blazed in his grip. With a long jump he landed in a crouch near the centaurs. Kratos reacted instantly to their attack, swinging the blade of Artemis and cutting the legs of a leading centaur from under it. A swift, circular motion lopped off the centaur's head and caused a blazing blue flame to erupt at one of the cardinal points in the circular pattern on the floor. He somersaulted, rolled to the side, and still barely managed to evade another of the Hades-spawned creatures. He came to his feet, swinging the weapon Artemis had granted him with powerful slashes that kept the remaining 3 centaurs at bay. But this was not the way of the Ghost of Sparta. To defend was to die. He attacked. With a mad cry, Kratos rushed forth, every cut of the blade exact and dangerous. He brought down another man-horse, jumped atop its fallen body, and rammed a sword blade down its throat. A new, different speck of light blazed on the circular pattern, the second antipodal to the first. The 2 remaining centaurs proved warier, or less confident, than their now dead companions. But this caution did not save them from Kratos's swinging, thrusting, slashing blade of magical blue fire. When he had sent the 2 remaining centaurs back to Hades and illuminated the final spots on the rotating ring on the floor, he heard a rumbling noise. Stone doors parted to reveal yet another corridor illuminated in the red-orange light of hell. A sense of urgency drove him now. He ran to the doors and through them, not bothering to look behind as they crashed shut. The tunnel was narrow, and he quickly found yet more of the architect's devices. Trap doors in the floor began opening to show pits of sulphurous lava before snapping closed again. He jumped these traps, only to find himself almost impaled by darts exploding from the walls. Kratos laughed without humor. He had endured far worse to reach this point. He would not be denied Pandora's box. He would kill the god of war and forever have his nightmares erased by the gods. He ran along the winding corridors, slaying wraiths and cursed legionnaires, hardly slowing in his headlong rush. In his gut, he knew his mission was almost over. Only 1 more room, 1 more adversary to kill, and Pandora's box would be his prize. The corridor opened onto a catwalk halfway up the distance to the vaulted ceiling, allowing him to peer back at where he had fired the ballista into the statue's chest. But Kratos looked straight down and saw rising from the lava pit a head, a horned head. Next came shoulders and crossed arms, forged from a dull black metal. He held the blades of chaos in his grip, but Kratos released them as the new statue of Lord Hades rose until a walkway jutting from around its neck came level with where he stood. Kratos gathered his strength and jumped as hard as he could, and barely caught the edge of the statue's shoulder. He kicked, then kicked harder, and rocked up, rolling onto the walkway. A handle protruded from the side of the neck. Like a sailor turning a windlass, Kratos put his back into it and pushed the spar about, turning the statue's head slowly. As it rotated, its mouth opened and a beam of eye-dazzling yellow light stabbed forth. Kratos saw that the beam hit the side of the huge room without effect. He pushed harder on the handle, turning the head about until the beam shone fully on the burned statue at the far end of the chamber. The burned spot began glowing until it was orange-hot, then red-hot. Kratos turned his arm to protect his eyes as it turned white-hot. Even at this distance, the heat proved enough to cause sweat to bead on his bare chest. With a puff of molten metal, the chest of the statue opened. He knew where his path lay. Descending the side of the new statue, Kratos returned to the floor and immediately faced another of the architect's diabolical traps. Rolling balls of molten rock spewed from the opening where he must go. The heat threatened to blister his bone-white skin, but Kratos never slowed. To do so would spell his death. Feet pounding against the floor, he ran forward as hard as he could, dodging the spheres of death as they tumbled outward. Less than 50 feet into the tunnel, a door emblazoned with Lord Hades's smirking face had been set into the wall. Rolling, diving, he crossed the pathway intermittently filled with molten death and grabbed the bottom of the door. From his right came another rock, thundering directly for him. With a convulsive yank, Kratos lifted the door and rolled under it a split second before the rock would have crushed and burned him. The tunnel stretched before him. Stride sure, he set off. He returned to the floor of the huge chamber, where molten rock poured down walls and lit with an eerie glow more suited to the underworld than a temple. This aspect was fearsome, but he saw at the far end of the chamber, guarding the way forward, what had to be the most deadly creature he had ever faced. Armored like a soldier, the Minotaur towered 30 feet above him. Every snort produced thick pillars of roiling black smoke from its nostrils, and as it opened its mouth, Kratos reacted instantly, spinning away from a gout of hellfire that singed his back and arms, in spite of his quick reaction. He somersaulted forward, drew the blades of chaos, and attacked. For all its size, the armored creature, which looked more like a machine than a living or undead beast, moved slowly and gave Kratos many opportunities to hammer at it. Bit by bit he chipped away its armor, but he eventually saw that this would never be enough. The creature was too large, too powerful, and withstood the most savage blows he could deliver with his weapons. After having used the blade of Artemis, Kratos knew that even this potent sword would not be enough. He rolled, barely avoiding a huge armored fist that crushed the floor and left only stony shards behind. He slashed with his swords, but produced nothing but a nick. The immense Minotaur reared up, and dazzling light shot forth from the gorget around its head. Wherever those beams touched the stone walls, huge holes appeared. The Minotaur swung its head about, roared, and drove both fists downward in an attempt to smash Kratos flat. He bounced one blade off an ironclad wrist, then rolled forward and cast forth the blades of chaos as if they were climbing hooks. He fastened the curved tips into the Minotaur's armor and yanked, hauling himself up onto the Minotaur's metal-spined back. Swinging around, he tugged hard, feet pressed into the creature's back, in an attempt to weaken the powerful neck muscles and bring up the head to expose the throat. The beast roared in defiance and again smashed its fists down hard on the ground, sending Kratos flying through the air. He landed flat on his back. Looking up, he saw the armored Minotaur's eyes blaze with infernal light. It opened its mouth and spewed deadly fire. Kratos rolled onto his belly and drew himself up barely in time to avoid the devastating breath. From this position, he launched himself again, blade swinging. He singled out the left wrist and succeeded in cutting the straps holding part of the gauntlet to the Minotaur's hand. It was so little, but it was a start. Kratos backed away, judged what had to be done, and then did it. He attacked, bringing the creature to its full height. Then he somersaulted to the side of the chamber, found the way up to the lower catwalk, and ran to the lever controlling the ballista. The creature roared, and its eyes flashed fiery red as it retaliated. When it opened its mouth to spew forth more flame, Kratos shoved the lever down and sent a ballista bolt directly into the monster's chest. It stood a little straighter, touched the spot where Kratos had ripped away several armor plates, then screeched in fury and came for him again. Kratos vaulted off the catwalk, hit the stone floor hard, and used some of his forward momentum to augment the power of his slashing attack. This time he severed part of the Minotaur's left wrist and was rewarded with a bellow that deafened him. He knew it could be hurt. That meant it could be killed. As he stepped up to take another cut, he grew careless. His minor victory had filled him with false confidence. The Minotaur's armored right fist crashed into his blades, tangling their chains, and Kratos found himself lifted high off the floor. Dangling from the chains fused to his forearms, Kratos was powerless to attack or escape. He stared into the Minotaur's burning eyes. The monstrous man-bull opened its mouth as if to bite him in two, but Kratos saw the fire within the creature's gut building. He was going to be roasted as he hung by the chains of his swords. A sharp jerk to the side set him spinning. He heaved and spun in the opposite direction, and then bunched his powerful belly muscles and kicked hard. The toe of his boot found purchase against a protruding spike on the Minotaur's shoulder armor. He swung away as the hell creature's searing flame erupted from its mouth. Kratos wrapped his legs around the armor spike, twisted as hard as he could, and wrenched himself upward and back. The chain snapped free, and he slid down the Minotaur's spine, fighting to keep from impaling himself on the spikes mounted everywhere. Kratos caught one, stopped his slide, and immediately renewed his attack. Again the blades of chaos served as hooks, but this time he penetrated the armor and sank their punishing tips into man-bull flesh. The Minotaur roared, reared, and tried to throw him off. Kratos hung on tenaciously, refusing to quit, to die. He got his feet under him and pulled as hard as he could on the chains until the blades ripped free, bringing with them gory hunks of the Minotaur's neck. From the way the creature's head drooped now, it was weakening. Grasping the hilts of his swords, Kratos jumped free, cutting at exposed man-bull at every possible opportunity. The left hand, where he had exposed flesh by cutting away armor, proved an exceptionally vulnerable area. He left deep, if not fatal, wounds all the way down the arm before he hit the stone floor once more. The Minotaur roared in frustration at its wounds, at being unable to crush the ghost of Sparta. It smashed its fists down in an attempt to turn him to bloody pulp, but again it missed by inches. Kratos waded in and severed an artery on the man-bull's left forearm. As the blood spurted forth, the creature roared, and light blazed from both neck and eyes. Kratos noted that whenever the deadly beams hit stone now, they caused less damage than before. He rolled, avoided another furious fist blow, and ran up the steps once more to the catwalk. The Minotaur vented its rage, reared, and presented him with a perfect target. He yanked hard on the lever, firing the ballista. The huge wooden shaft sailed forth and hit the Minotaur in the face, pinning the monster to the door. It shuddered as death throes racked its monstrous body, its thunderous roaring slowly fading. Kratos caught his breath, waiting for the door to open. It did not. The Minotaur hung suspended from the still secured door. Other than the hissing as lava waterfalled from the highest reaches of the chamber, There was only silence. A final convulsive spasm left the Minotaur a ghastly decoration mocking Kratos in its death. His rage mounted. Looking around for another ballista bolt and not finding it only fed his anger. The Minotaur had died from the heavy shaft. Kratos had thought to send another through it to break down the door, but this was denied him. Pulling the Blades of Chaos out, he dropped from the catwalk and stormed forward, the deadly swords hissing through the air as he swung them. He would carve up the Minotaur, then hack his way through the door. He would not be denied. As he approached, he saw a new danger. Blood dripped from the man-bull's sundered head. Every drop hissed and burned the stone floor. The pools of black blood spread, forcing him to vault over them. Then Kratos looked up and saw the horned head loll to the side as it pulled free of the impaling bolt. What had been a steady drip of blood now became a waterfall. Kratos sprinted forward. Spartans never retreated. He winced as the acid blood spattered his back, his arms, his legs. Pain goaded him forward until he slammed into the door next to a huge bull leg. Panting, he looked up at the body, which was now slowly sliding down the door because the head had pulled free of the bolt. More Minotaur blood cascaded downward, but Kratos ignored it when he saw the condition of the door that had blocked his progress. A crack in the door made its way downward from where the ballista bolt had slammed through the Minotaur. Hope flared. Kratos drove both blades into the thin fissure. His powerful shoulders screamed in exertion as he levered apart the crack. At first, nothing happened. The blades did not budge, and the crack did not widen. His entire world was reduced to the pressure he applied to the blades and the waterfall of poisonous blood from above. Pain, burning, his muscles at the breaking point. Then Kratos vented a victory cry. The crack exploded in all directions as a section of the door shattered like glass, giving him a crevice hardly the size of his massive body. He turned sideways, squeezed through, and fell to his knees on the far side of the door, only to roll forward as torrents of Minotaur blood gushed after him. Kratos stood and ran down the new passageway, winding back and forth through the walls, until he came to a sarcophagus matching the one he had found earlier. A stone book on a pedestal commemorated the death of the architect's second son. With a savage growl, Kratos jumped to the top of the coffin. He shoved back the lid and tore off the head of this mummified body. He held it high, but, unlike before, he did not think to throw it from him. He stared at it and knew what to do with it, where it fit, knew that it was the key to the Temple of Pandora. Retracing his steps to the rings of Pandora, he avoided the stone roller and once more stood on the rim of the water-filled core. Below he had found a door that blocked his way, a door with a skull etched into the stone. Kratos dived down, kicking powerfully through the water, and hung in front of the portal. Pressing the skull into the outline on the door caused the water to drain all about him. The water level in the central pool descended rapidly, allowing him to pull open the door. Behind the door was an elevator. He stepped in, and the cage dropped downward with a speed that took away his breath. The sudden stop drove Kratos to his knees, but when the door opened, he knew where he was. He stepped out to claim Pandora's box. 24. Kratos stood in a circular room with two arches exactly opposite each other that opened on corridors leading away. He rocked back, expecting creatures or fighters to pour through one or both of the archways. Back pressed against a blank wall, he waited for death to rush forth. Nothing came. He looked around, baffled. Had there been one other room in this entire infinite ancient complex that did nothing at all? No monsters, no death traps, no impossible obstacles? Two exits. That was all. For the first time, he was starting to worry. He walked to one archway and peered through. The floor turned in a downward spiral, cutting off his view of what lay more than a few feet away. He pressed his ear against the wall. Nothing. He spun about, sword leveled, but nothing was creeping up behind him. The other archway differed from the first, only in that the corridor spiraled upward instead of down. A simple choice, a straightforward choice, up or down. Athena had said that Pandora's box rested at the summit, and that downward lay only defeat and death. He supposed he'd gone a bit far to start doubting the goddess now. He moved carefully onto the upward spiral, stalking upward with blades in hand, ready for anything. Almost anything. Anything except what he found. The space he came upon was huge, open to a midnight sky and the cold shimmer of countless stars. There was light here, though. Firelight. This firelight was the color of burning cities, and it shone from the hair and beard atop the mountainous figure of the armed and armored god before him. A terrible icy shock raked his body and shook him like a dead leaf in a winter gale. His voice came out a whisper, a bare breath. Ares. Gods always hear their name when called, even if only in the dream of some creature on the far side of the world. Kratos's whisper brought the god of war wheeling about like a thunderstorm spinning into a tornado. Kratos! Ares's voice grated like a landslide. I knew you were too stupid to run from me forever! And now that the end had come, Kratos discovered he was ready for this, after all.
Run? From you?
Kratos shouted at the top of his lungs, throwing wide his arms to flourish the blades of chaos.
You train me too well. I learn too much to ever run.
Ares drew his warship-sized blade with a sound like the screams of murdered children. His flaming hair rained fire down upon Kratos as the god stepped forward.
You talk like a man, but you shake like a woman. Did your wife shiver so?
All hope of restraint incinerated in the white fire of Kratos's rage. He hurled himself at the god with every shred of his superhuman strength, releasing the blades of chaos and drawing the sword given him by Artemis from behind his neck. As he fell, he drove the irresistible edge of the blade down like a spike through the foot of the god. The blade of Artemis drove into Olympian flesh to its very hilt, and Ares laughed.
I thank you, Spartan. Sand fleas had given me a terrible itch.
I'll give you more, Kratos snarled, as he rolled himself across the god's instep. He leaped headlong up toward Ares's knee. Artemis's sword raised to slice the hamstring, but the huge blade of the god flashed downward and slapped Kratos from the air as though the Spartan were no more than a wasp or a biting fly. Kratos hurled through the air until he crashed into a wall with stunning force. The rock at his back crumbled, and he slid down it to the ground, trying to shake the blurriness from his eyes and the ringing from his ears. The god had bladed him, slapped him with the flat of the blade, as a Spartan father disciplines a naughty child. Ares didn't respect him enough to use the edge.
"And why should I?" said the god.
As if he could hear Kratos's thoughts. You would be no more than picked bones and crow shit had I not saved you.
Do you remember, Spartan? Do you remember falling to your knees with tears on your cheeks as you begged me like a whipped cur, like a slave, to save your worthless life? If one of your men had begged you thus, you would have killed him for dishonoring Sparta.
You should have killed me, Kratos growled. My weakness dishonored Sparta, and all the world would be better today if I had died on that field.
Your Spartan honor means nothing to me.
You begged, I answered. I arose from my bed on Olympus and descended upon that field to dry your tears, to fight your battle for you, to win where you had lost, to triumph where you had failed.
The god lifted one house-sized foot, as if to crush Kratos like an ant beneath his sandal.
Kratos tried to dive out of the way, but the god was as fast as he was huge. The sandal pinned Kratos face down to the ground. Kratos tasted dirt and blood, and in that second he saw himself again, battered to the bloody earth by the immense war mallet of the barbarian king. He heard his voice cry out to Ares and swear eternal servitude.
Do you remember what you said to me that day? The price you set for your worthless survival? Say it now, Kratos. Say it.
The pressure of the vast sandal crushing his back increased. Kratos felt his ribs cracking, and he could no longer draw a breath. And he heard in his memory the words he had spoken on that day. My life is yours, Lord Ares. I swear it. But here and now he could not make his lips form the words. He tried. He did try, telling himself that 9 little words meant nothing, that to give the god his petty victory would mean Kratos might yet have another chance to recover Pandora's box and face the blood-mad Olympian on equal terms. But the words would not come out. He couldn't even truly think them. The room and the crushing weight of the god all vanished behind the visions, the waking nightmares that had turned his life to an ocean of blood and suffering. He had served Ares not only with his sword arm, but with his whole heart, his mind, and every scrap of his gift for unstoppable brutality. The army of Sparta became invincible. Opposing warriors quaked in fear to see Kratos's Spartans take the field. At the first javelin cast, they dropped their weapons and ran home to tremble behind their mother's skirts. The fist of Ares gave no quarter. Fleeing soldiers would be cut down, to a man. Parties suing for peace were brutally slaughtered. All the world trembled before the battle cry of the Spartans when Kratos stood at their head. No quarter, no prisoners. No mercy. Many were the princes who pled with Kratos to accept their surrender, to save a remnant of their army and their city, even if it meant slavery in a Spartan kitchen. He refused to hear such pleas. Surrender was never granted. Victory or death in battle were the only acceptable outcomes. Kratos expected no less from his own soldiers. Kratos told his soldiers that he killed because Ares commanded him. But in truth he killed for his own pleasure. He killed because slaughter was his gift, his passion, because he loved nothing more than the smell of blood, the screams of the dying, the sight of an army of corpses rotting on the battlefield. And if that were true, rumbled the god who now held him pinned in the arena, you would still be the fist of Ares on earth. And the world would still quake at the merest rumor of Sparta marching out to war. It was because you did not love me enough, Kratos. Because your heart still held close your...
No, Kratos croaked out with the last of his voice. No!
The visions took him wholly now. He saw himself on the very last night he had served the god of war.
The villagers presumed to kneel first before Athena. Before Athena! This place is an affront to Ares. Burn it to the ground.
Kratos grabbed a torch and sent it spinning through the night to land atop a thatched roof. The tiny sparks became a fire, and then the entire roof collapsed, devouring the hut in minutes. With a battle cry, Kratos led his horde of savage murderers into the village. The few villagers coming out to defend their homes were armed with shovels and planting sticks, without hope of resistance against his battle-hardened warriors. Kratos strode through the melee, hacking and slashing, killing without effort, without even really noticing whom he might be slaying, until he came to the village temple. The temple of Athena, and the wizened, age-crabbed old witch of an oracle who thought to bar his passage. A knot formed in his belly. The stench of burning meat combined with wood and thatch as house after house was reduced to cinders. The temple looked deserted, but some dark foreboding gave Kratos pause. But it was a shrine to Athena. Its existence was the reason for this massacre. How could he leave it standing?
"Everyone out!" he shouted, rapping hard on the thick wood door with the pommel of his blade.
When no one answered, he stepped back and used the blades of chaos to reduce the door to splinters. A small, hunched-over Nubian woman shuffled out. She wore a shining green gown marked with the letter Omega on the front.
"Sacrilege," she said, shaking her finger at him. "Beware of blaspheming against the goddess, Kratos. Do not enter this place."
Kratos backhanded the old woman, knocking her to the ground. "Never presume to give a Spartan orders." He kicked open the door and rushed into the temple. Two priests came toward him. The blades of chaos flashed and delivered fiery death to both men. Kratos roared in rage when other supplicants in the temple stirred. He rushed forward, not needing to even see his victims, as he cut left, right, left, and then plunged ahead. There was no thought of restraint, no need for caution. There was only blood and death and triumph. Kratos in his element. And so he did not heed the last of his victims, and he did not hesitate to slaughter the last two supplicants in the village temple, a woman and her young daughter. The terrible shock of what he had done shattered the vision and brought him back to the temple arena where the god now crushed out his life. But at that instant, miraculously, the weight on his back vanished. Ares had lifted his foot away and once more returned to the center of the huge arena.
"Come on, you contemptible nothing, you insane murderer. You wanted a fight? Let's fight."
Kratos picked himself up from the floor and shook the fog out of his head. The foot that the god had lowered upon his back had been the same one he'd stabbed with Artemis's sword. He saw clearly the gouge left in the stone by the magical blade as it had spiked down through godly flesh. But that gouge in the floor was dry as the desert of lost souls outside. There was no blood. Kratos looked at the wall behind him, at the smear of shadows he cast in the light of the ubiquitous braziers. He looked at the wall beyond Ares, where the god's gargantuan form cast no shadows at all. Ares wasn't Ares. The god wasn't real.
"I am real enough to break you, Spartan. You want to kill me? Come on and try, you miserable mortal."
Kratos's ribs still ached with the memory of the god's sandal crushing him to the floor. Blood still trickled from a gash on his skull where his skin had split under the impact of the flat of Ares's blade. Though it seemed Kratos could not harm this Ares, the reverse clearly did not apply.
"Why do you wait? Do you realize now how hopeless it is to try to kill a god?"
Kratos did want to kill Ares. His lust for the god's blood burned like sunfire in his veins. But this was not Ares. No wonder the god seemed to be reading his mind. This phantasmal god was itself a product of his mind. Like the barbarian king in his visions, like his nightmares of his wife and his daughter. To destroy this phantom Ares, Kratos would have to be strong enough to prevail against his own mind. But if he had such strength, he would never have needed to take service under Athena in the first place. He would have been strong enough to conquer his nightmares, to banish the memories of his crime on his own. But he didn't have that strength. He knew it. For 10 years he'd labored to silence the voices in his head, to blind the eye of his memory. This phantasmal Ares was a foe he could never defeat until he conquered himself. Kratos backed away. 25. As dawn caressed the eastern desert with her rose-red fingers, Kratos stood on the roof of a huge building atop a mountain, the mountain that grew from the midst of the Temple of Pandora, which itself was built up from the mountain chained to the back of the laboring Titan who bore it on his eternal crawl through the desert of lost souls. And in the first gleam of Helios's chariot on the far horizon, three huge figures around him shone and shimmered, statues, hundreds of feet tall, of the brother kings. Zeus, Poseidon, and Hades stood facing one another, and the hands of all three were extended to support a disk the size of a marching field with a hole in the middle, like a wagon wheel of the same material as the statues themselves. This material, Some mystical substance more transparent than glass reflected the glints and highlights thrown off by the statue's curves. Below where the golden chariot had yet to touch, the brother kings were wholly invisible. Kratos trotted toward them. Athena had said the box rested at the summit of the temple, and obviously nothing stood higher than these. But when he reached them, their bases on the dawn-shadowed roof were not only invisible, they were insubstantial, as though the statues did not exist except in the light of dawn. Kratos scowled upward at the images of the gods. His opportunity to reach the treasure they supported would last only as long as the dawn itself. Zeus stood to the east, and so more of his statue was exposed to the dawn light. Kratos sprang to the figure of the King of Olympus and leaped high to see if he could touch the statue where the dawn struck it. At the top of his leap, he felt a surface warm and solid, but more slippery than oiled glass. He drew one of the blades and leaped again to strike the statue. The only effect his blade could produce was to make the immense statue ring like a great crystal bell. Not so much as a scratch marred the nearly invisible surface. But instead of fading like a sounding bell, this ring deepened and broadened, becoming louder and louder until Kratos had to clap hands over his ears against the growing pain. Poseidon's statue was the next closest to the eastern edge of the roof. Kratos ran to it, steeling himself for the blast of sound he knew would come when he took his hands from his ears, then leaped into the dawn light and struck Poseidon too with a powerful blow from a blade of chaos. The belling that rose was deeper, more resonant, and grew in power more swiftly than had the sound from Zeus. Farthest from the rise of dawn, appropriately enough, thought Kratos, stood Hades, king of the underworld. And this note sparked by Kratos's blow was darker and deeper still. The volume of their conjoined chord rose until it seemed to Kratos that there was nothing in the world except sound. Hands over his ears did him no further good. He staggered to the central point between the three statues and fell to his knees. As the rising sun finally struck the spot where he huddled, what had been featureless stone became a magically clear window. Directly below him he saw the chamber of the architect, with its throne, on which the armored figure sat as though oblivious to the universe-destroying sonic blast from above. This disk felt to be the same sort of substance as the statues, which his best effort had not managed to even scratch. Now that he thought of it, though, he recalled a tale of the great brass gong of Rhodes. It was said to ring so powerfully that it shattered glass for a league or farther. Since it seemed as if much more of this noise would do the same to his skull, Kratos decided there could be no harm in trying. He reached down to the transparent disk and rapped it sharply, once, with his knuckle. The disk instantly shattered with a sharp report, scattering shards so tiny as to become dancing motes of dust. The awful sound fell to instant silence. Kratos plummeted through the hole like a stone down a well. A convulsive wrench of his body twisted him enough in the air that he could catch himself by straddling the architect, one foot on either arm of the throne. The throne began to rotate, with much grinding and clattering of gears. Kratos sprang from the arms to the dais on which the throne rested. The rotation stopped.
"So, architect," Kratos said, "you foretold my death. Yet here I am."
The Corinthian helmet turned just enough that Kratos could see cold green fire through the eye slits.
"No man has ever survived the arena of remembrance. Until now. But Pandora's box will never be yours."
The architect raised an armored finger, and the lid of the box on his lap slid open. Kratos seized the architect's wrist in a grip no mortal being could break. The armor was shockingly warm.
"No more tricks," Kratos said. "Tell me how to reach the box, and I will let you live." "You will not, for I am not."
Kratos tightened his grip on the architect's wrist until the armor buckled under his fingers.
"You're alive enough to speak.
So you're alive enough to suffer.
Do as you will.
Kratos snarled and clenched his fist. The armor crumpled like a dry leaf, but from his crushing grasp no blood flowed, only steam, hot enough to scald Kratos' hand. With a curse, Kratos wrenched on the arm, and it tore away at the shoulder. From the severed joint hissed another burst of steam, which faded away as a metal plate within the armor slid into place over the hole. Kratos scowled down into the armor, empty of flesh or bone, containing only brass tubing and gears of unfamiliar design.
"What manner of creature are you?"
"I am," said the voice,
which Kratos now noted seemed to come from beneath the dais rather than from the helmet.
"What remains of the architect? I am his final device."
Kratos' eyes widened.
"The Antikythera."
"I control the temple. I am the keeper of its final challenge. Look into the box on my lap."
Kratos stepped closer and peered into the device filled with a multitude of tiny rods. Needles, Kratos realized, set on end and packed together. Here and there some of these needles were depressed to one height or another. The depressions were exactly the diameter of the armored fingers in the empty gauntlet in Kratos' hand. He guessed their height and conformation somehow controlled the various mechanisms throughout the temple. There were also needles mounted horizontally on all four walls.
"Press them anywhere."
Kratos considered this. There could easily be more going on in this box than just the needles, and those were discolored at their tips. Poison? What poison could still kill after 1,000 years? If anyone would have known the answer to that question, it would have been the architect. Instead of his own finger, Kratos used the armored finger of the gauntlet he held. Instantly, the horizontal needles licked out from the walls and stabbed the finger of the gauntlet. Rebounding from the bronze, the needles returned to their places.
"Had you pressed with your own finger, your hand would be trapped, pinned in place by the needles, and you would be dying, in tremendous pain, from the blood of the Lernian Hydra that paints every tip."
"So, I must guess the shape that will reveal Pandora's box?"
"No,"
the architect, or rather the Antikythera, replied.
"I will tell you. It is the shape of a man's face, pressed into the needles."
Kratos thought about the many statues and reliefs throughout the temple. Surely the head of a man-sized statue.
"The face must be of flesh. The needles must drive fully in and remain in place," the emotionless voice said. "To reach Pandora's box, a man must die."
Kratos thought of the man in the cage. For one brief moment, he regretted having killed the old fool.
"And this is your only chance. This confirmation of the needles will work for only a tiny span after the window above is shattered. Once the chariot of Helios rules the sky, the statues, and the box on the disk they bear will vanish into the noonday light. Only you have reached this far. No one to follow will have a chance at all."
Kratos nodded. He appreciated the elegant intricacy of this final trap. He said,
"But you always, that is, the architect, your creator, leave one way through."
"Until now."
Kratos squinted up at the disk, supported by the hands of the brother kings, far above in the shining sun. He now saw a speck upon it, and his heart swelled with rage. He had not come so far to be denied. Here, where he could see the box, he would not allow himself to fail.
"Athena herself has told me that there is no way out of this temple without Pandora's box," he said. "So I will die here, in success, or die later, for my failure."
"You are about to die."
"Since I am about to die, there is no further need for secrets, is there?" Kratos said,
Tell me why this temple was designed in this way. Tell me why each trap, maze, and puzzle has a solution. Why design fantastical defenses around the most powerful weapon in creation, but deliberately design each of them with a hole?
Because Zeus commanded it so.
Zeus? Kratos frowned. But why?
I am a loyal servant of the gods. I do not question. I obey.
The logic was obvious. Zeus commanded that every puzzle have an answer, every trap an escape, and the architect was fanatically loyal, which could only mean that this final deadly puzzle was no different from the others. The architect had placed his sons in coffins. At Zeus's bidding? Their heads had proven to be the key to gaining entry to progressively dangerous challenges. Twice this had happened. Twice. Would the architect so misuse his children unless...
One last question.
Your time is growing short.
I know, Kratos said, thinking. So is yours. My final question. How can a mere device, a steam-powered mechanism, no matter how cleverly designed, understand and respond to whatever I say?
Without waiting for a reply, Kratos sprang to the rear of the throne with pantherish agility and seized with both hands the Corinthian helmet that rested upon the armored shoulders. It seemed to be more firmly anchored than the arm had been. Kratos had to twist fiercely and wrench upward with all his strength to rip it free. Then he tucked the helmet under one arm and reached inside with his other hand, scooping out what he found, as he would a snail from its shell. It was a human head. Whatever hair once adorned it had centuries ago crumbled to dust. But this head clearly still held some semblance of life. Tears spurted from its rolling eyes, its mouth worked silently, and the voice from below the dais finally exhibited some emotion. Terror.
Stop! What are you doing? You can't...
I can. He thought he should really tell the ancient undead who tended the fires out front that he'd been right all along and that the insane architect of the Temple of Pandora did still live, haunting his millennial masterpiece. In his hands was the key to the final lock. Kratos saw no reason to hesitate.
No! No, 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 please!
Kratos jammed the undying head of the architect face first into the box. The pipe and reed voice below the dais screamed in panic and despair as the poison needle stabbed out from all four walls of the box and upward from below. They lodged in his face, in his neck, drove through his temples and punctured his eyeballs as one might lance a boil. With his lips pinned to his teeth, even the architect's artificial voice could only moan and whimper without words. The walls of the chamber groaned as they came alive to lower themselves around Kratos. An instant later he realized that it was the dais of the throne where he stood that was instead lifting, becoming a rising pillar of stone that went up and up, fitting perfectly through the hole left in the ceiling by the shattered window. Outside it rose still more and more, lifting Kratos and the throne hundreds of feet into the air, until finally it thrust him up through the hole in the center of the enormous disk, and stopped. Kratos stood for a moment, feeling the eyes of the brother kings upon him. Only a pace or two in front of him stood a vast chest, as tall as Kratos and thrice as wide, constructed of impossibly lustrous metalwork that surrounded golden jewels larger than his head. And so, there it was. Pandora's box. At last. But Kratos felt no relief, no triumph, for this was not the end of his quest. It was only one more point along the way. The end of this story must lie in Athens. He glanced upward and saw that the head of Zeus's statue had vanished down to his eyebrows, dematerializing in the rising sun of the day. As he watched, the cirrus clouds of Zeus's eyebrows evaporated, and then so did the top of Poseidon's head. He sprang from the throne, raced across the transparent disk toward the enormous box. and discovered a new problem when he tried to come to a stop. He couldn't. He slid right into the box with breathtaking impact, which also pushed the box a few paces farther from the throne pillar. The mysterious substance was still more slippery than oiled glass. Kratos looked around in desperation as he carefully circled to the far side of the box. Flames trapped within the sides blazed. The golden gems encrusting the top pulsed with energy. But none of this helped him. He'd never get enough purchase on this surface to push or pull something so massive. If only he had something to throw, perhaps he could knock it on its way. But what could he throw that would have enough heft to move the box? It struck him that the placement of the box on the disk would not have been an accident. It was almost halfway to the rim, and it rested exactly on the line between the throne pillar and the statue of Zeus, as though this final test had been designed specifically for him. Looking up at the vanishing statue of the Sky Father, Kratos realized that Zeus himself had given him the one and only possible way to move that enormous weight on this impossibly slick surface in so short a time. He took a few careful paces toward the statue and inclined his head.
"Lord Zeus, did you foresee this moment? Is this why you granted me a fraction of your power?"
With no answer forthcoming, Kratos wheeled and reached back over his right shoulder to grasp the solid lightning of the thunderbolt. He took up a wide stance for balance and threw the thunderbolt at the disk just short of the box. The impressive detonation had exactly the effect Kratos had hoped for. The box slid a few feet toward the throne pillar. Six more thunderbolts pushed it to the very edge of the pillar itself. Kratos scrambled around to the firmer footing of the pillar and set his foot against the back of the architect's throne.
"You love the gods so much,"
Kratos said as he kicked the throne off the pillar and sent it spinning toward the statue of Hades.
"Stay with them forever."
He turned, took hold of a projecting piece of the box's metalwork, and dragged the vessel of Ares's destruction onto the pillar, which immediately began to descend. On the long, long trip downward, Kratos could only stare at the box pensively. He had been told this thing was a weapon, the only weapon that would allow a mortal to slay a god. Yet Zeus had commanded the architect to design the temple so that a mortal might achieve ultimate success and claim its power. He remembered the words of Athena. "Zeus has forbidden the gods to wage war on one another." Such a decree must be binding, even upon Zeus himself. Had Zeus ordered a single path be left open, because, even 1,000 years ago, he had foreseen that some day a god must be killed?
26. "You chose well, my daughter," Zeus said, as together they watched the scrying pool display the slow descent of the architect's throne pillar.
"Ares chose, I refined," Athena said, unwilling to take her eyes from the image of Kratos until the Spartan and Pandora's box reached the entrance level of the temple. "My brother did not understand what he had in Kratos."
"And so he blunted his best weapon.
A weapon that is now deadlier than Ares could ever have forged," Athena said. They watched the progress of her mortal as he looked around the temple atop the mountain behind Athens. "A question, my lord. Is this the result of your planning?" He turned from her to point. "Father," she began again, but the king of Olympus simply nodded toward the scrying pool, where the throne pillar still descended on its steady pace through the innumerable floors of the temple.
"Your Spartan has nearly reached the temple's antechamber," he said. "Is there anything you want to tell him before he goes outside?"
"Why do you ask?"
"Once he brings the box out of the temple, events might begin to unfold swiftly."
Athena saw that the descending pillar had now reached the antechamber itself, extending downward through the ceiling until it broke through the floor below and continued to sink. The earthquakes this triggered began to shake the whole temple, as well as the mountains above and below it. Chunks of masonry burst outward from the mechanical stresses, and boulders began to rain down upon Kronos' head. She willed herself from Olympus to the antechamber of the Temple of Pandora, where she stood, waiting invisibly, while the throne pillar ground its way down to reveal Kratos and Pandora's box. The Spartan appeared unusually pensive as he put his shoulder to the box and began to shove it toward the immense outer doors of the temple. At his touch, a great spray of crackling energy erupted from the giant gemstones. Athena gathered the sizzling lightning into a semblance of her face. "Kratos, your quest is at an end. You are the first mortal to ever reach Pandora's box. There is still time to save Athens. You must bring the box back to my city and use it to kill Ares." Kratos lifted his eyes to meet hers, and she noted how meeting the challenges required to free Pandora's box had changed him. Bloodlust had been tempered with thoughtfulness. Mercy was beyond his pale, but he had been forged into a more potent weapon, one that would surprise Ares. "Return to Athens, Kratos," she said. "Return and save my city." As she willed herself back to Olympus, Athena heard Kratos's grunt as he began pushing the ponderous box. She rematerialized before the throne of Zeus. Zeus, to her surprise, was still there, still watching the scrying pool.
"He's opening the doors."
"Watch," he said.
"Here it comes."
"Father, I must transport Kratos and Pandora's box back to—"
"Don't worry about it."
"But, Father, even to lower the box from Kronos's back—"
"I said," Zeus snapped, "don't worry about it."
"With every passing second, more of my city burns." Zeus gestured down at the images in the reflecting pool.
"Watch."
As Kratos pushed Pandora's box out from the temple into the morning sun of the Desert of Lost Souls for the first time in 1,000 years, Zeus gestured, and the scene in the pool changed. Athens lay in flames. Ares strode through the streets, stamping fleeing Athenians, laughing as his sword slashed whole neighborhoods to rubble and hammer blows squashed houses flat. His evil laughter echoed from the mountains to the harbor. As the god of war lifted a fist to smash another building, he paused, fist upraised, and turned to the east, as though an invisible hand had tapped him on the shoulder.
"So, little Spartan, you've recovered Zeus's precious box."
The flames of Ares's hair blazed like the sun. His eyes burned with a fury not to be contained, and his entire body shook as anger fed his muscles.
"You will not live to see it opened."
Ares reached down to snap off one of the great marble columns of the Parthenon. The god hefted it as though the column were no more than a child's toy spear, but one with a deadly, jagged point. He ran 4 ground-shaking steps and hurled his prodigious javelin, which streaked upward into the sky so fast it vanished with a thunderclap. Ares turned back to his task of destruction, a sneer on his face. He did not even bother to watch his weapon strike.
"Goodbye, Spartan! You will rot in the depths of Hades for all eternity."
His laughter pealed over the ruins of Athens like the doom horn of Hades himself.
"Father, stop him!"
"Athena," Zeus interrupted sharply, "your plans are at an end. There is only one more thing for you to do until this is all over."
Athena lowered her head, worrying about Kratos's fate and that of her city.
"And what is that, Father?"
"Watch."
27. Kratos's feet kept slipping. He moved closer to Pandora's box, got his legs under him, and pushed harder. The monstrous box moved slowly. Weighing an imponderable amount, the box proved difficult to slide even across the polished floor of the antechamber. The earthquakes caused him to lose what little traction he found under his sandals. Even as he finally shoved the box through the titanic doors, more masonry tumbled and shattered around him. With the box in the doorway, Kratos stopped to gather his strength for one last hard shove, and found himself gazing up at the beauty of the desert sky. vivid cerulean, shading toward indigo in the west, studded with clouds that took on curious shapes that chilled his soul. But there was more up there than clouds. Four specks drifted high in the sky, slipping in and out of feathery clouds, only to reappear as dark, almost invisible dots, warning of approaching danger. Harpies. His attention returned to Pandora's box. He had no idea how he'd lower it from Kronos's back, let alone drag it across the desert of lost souls. He reached up and gripped the lid. No matter how hard he shoved, the lid refused to budge. Taking the entire box back to Athens would be easier if he possessed whatever power lay locked within. While it might not grant him the ability to move this massive box from Pandora's temple all the way to Athens, he guessed it would make the task easier. He tried to slide the lid, lift it, swing it to the side, but whatever force locked this box was more than he could overcome. Perhaps it could only be opened after he took it to Athens, or the box might have to be placed in Athena's temple, where her oracle could use it to bestow the power upon him. Kratos wished he knew more, but he didn't have the time to waste in speculation. He started pushing again. Getting out of Pandora's temple had to be his first goal. When finally he had shoved the box fully outside, the massive doors of the temple boomed shut behind him. He stopped to catch his breath and to choose a path. He squinted at the sky, and the harpies on their way down. And one of those low clouds suddenly developed a large hole in the middle, as if Zeus had shoved his finger through it. A ripple spread outward from the hole, like the ripples from a stone tossed in a still pool. Kratos's scowl deepened. With only an instant's flash of white, his chest was struck by an invisible hammer, wielded by an invisible titan. Nothing in all his decades of battle had ever hit him so hard. The impact blasted him backward off his feet and drove him flying into the vast stone door of the Temple of Pandora. Pinned to the stone door, blinking his incomprehension at the immense white marble column sticking out of his chest, Kratos fought to breathe. The spear of marble had struck so fast he never saw it until he was already hit. He looked down and knew he had only seconds of life remaining in his rapidly failing body. He could not speak, for his lungs had been punched from his chest along with his heart and liver, stomach and spleen. Weakly he scrabbled at the column. He knew that only the last drops of blood in his brain gave him awareness in these final seconds. And even in death, the nightmares would not leave him. He again saw his career, his life as a man and as a weapon in the hands of the war god. He saw his victories beyond number, murders beyond all imagination. But two murders he didn't have to imagine. He remembered them. He saw them every night in his dreams. He saw the ancient, wizened village oracle and again heard her words.
"Beware of blaspheming against the goddess, Kratos. Do not enter this place."
If only he'd had the wisdom to heed her words. And the massacre in the village temple replayed in his mind once more, as it had every night for 10 long years. The murder of the priests, the slaughter of Athena's worshippers huddled there. And then the final two, a woman and a girl, only silhouettes against the fires he had set to burn the temple and every building in the village. Those last two silhouettes, who didn't fall to their knees, didn't try to run away, didn't beg or plead for their lives. Kratos again felt the blade sear through their flesh, and he knew when their souls fled, sent to Hades, as he had done to so many others. He had killed too many for too long not to be an efficient soldier. Too efficient. His final two victims had not fallen to their knees, had not tried to flee, did not beg or plead for their lives, because Kratos's wife and his daughter could not believe that their husband and father would ever hurt them. Kratos again felt himself fall to his knees, and that it was he who begged, who pleaded, who wished he could flee what he found there. Once more he was haunted by the sight of his beloved wife, his precious daughter, lying in pools of their own blood, slaughtered like lambs by his own hand.
My wife! My child! How?
The words had choked him, a final fatal question that he asked of no one, because he was the only living creature within that burning temple.
They were left safe in Sparta.
The flames of the temple had answered him, in the voice of his master.
You are becoming all I'd hoped you'd be, Kratos. Now, with your wife and child dead, nothing will hold you back. You will become even stronger. You will become death itself.
On that night, Kratos realized his true enemy was the god he had served all too faithfully. Upon the cold bodies of the only two people on earth he had ever loved, Kratos swore a terrible oath. He would not rest until the god of war was destroyed. The ancient village witch, Athena's oracle in that tiny village, had come upon him as he stood by the pyre on which he burned the bodies of his beloved wife and his precious daughter. For only a moment, her senile cackle had transformed into words clear and strong, in a voice from the gods themselves.
From this night forward, the mark of your terrible deed will be visible to all. The ashes of your wife and child will remain fastened to your skin, never to be removed.
As the ashes had arisen from their resting place and painted themselves upon his skin forever, Kratos was able only to stand, to swallow his grief, and to accept the doom the gods had pronounced upon him. With that curse, all would know him for the beast he had become. His skin white with the ash of his dead family, the ghost of Sparta was born. But he had never dreamed he would come so close. He had never dreamed he would die in the desert of lost souls, Pandora's box itself the last sight his failing eyes would ever behold. As the darkness of death closed down his vision, the four harpies flapped down from the sky, seized the box in their talons, and lifted away again. West, toward Athens. Knowing how completely he had failed, he could no longer hold on to life. With one last convulsive shudder, Kratos died. But for the ghost of Sparta, even death was not the end. 28. Kratos fell, and fell, and fell alongside hundreds of other men and women falling beside him. He plunged through the blood-hazed gloom of Hades, falling toward the shores of the River Styx. He knew this place. He had been here before. But his previous sojourn had been as a living man.